Good morning. We'll like everybody to take their seats so we can get going on just slightly delayed. I hope everybody enjoyed last evening. Today we have a really superb group of speakers and discussants. Great pleasure to begin with the keynote speaker, my friend and colleague, Joshua Rao. Today we're going to address, in the beginning, the other of what I consider the two big issues of the Trump era. The first is sort of national security and international relations, which we talked about last night a little bit. And today, we're delighted to have Josh Rao, who is the Orman Family Professor of Finance at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business, and is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, where he runs probably the most important research initiative at Hoover, which is the State and Local Government Initiative. Josh is a sought-after speaker, of course, was the principal chief economist on President Trump's Council of Economic Advisors during the Trump 1 administration. He has testified frequently before all the important committees of the U.S. federal government, House of Representatives and Senate, and has received numerous awards for his scholarship and his very what you will see is a unique, very clear way to articulate complicated economic ideas. In fact, because I'm not an economist, I'm always bothering Josh with what are very mundane questions, but somehow I walk away understanding, which is not true of all the economists who I speak with. So we'll have a chance to hear what Josh's thoughts are first on what we sort of call Trumponomics, which is the America First economic plan, and then we'll have a discussion. So please welcome Josh Rao.
Thanks, Scott. Great pleasure to be here. And it's amazing to see what GLI has been able to do over the years since Scott and I co-founded it. Scott has just done such a terrific job putting this this program together and this event, and it's terrific to see the Rising Leaders Network growing and thriving. So, my topic for today is Trumponomics. Well, Trumponomics is an evolving concept. So let me speak broadly before getting into specifics. I think there are two key broad points that underlie Trumponomics and really the Trump administration's entire policy concept. One is, of course, the desire to place America's interests first, and the observation that prior administrations weren't necessarily doing that. Now, for some reason, this has been something of a controversial idea, but government serving people actually have a duty to put the interest of their people first. Fortunately, much of economics is not actually a zero-sum game where the economic interests of people in one country are at odds with those of another country. There are some areas where those interests are in conflict, but the truth is that many things that are good for America are also good for the rest of the world. So in my view, the general principle is correct. Voters are right to demand a government that places national interests first. And President Trump's popularity has stemmed from that, has come from that to a large extent. So part of my remarks is going to be evaluating the extent to which I think the Trump administration's economic policies are achieving that, are doing what is best for the American people. Second point is a point that Scott made last night, second broad point, which is that President Trump's policies are about disruption, and in particular, disrupting a regime that was not working for many Americans. This regime involved high taxes, very, very high levels of regulation at all levels of government, subsidization of alternative and unreliable sources of energy, and excessive dependence on China and many other problems. It also included levels of government spending under the Biden administration that generated inflation that had not been seen for decades. So in the election, you know, yes, border security was important, crime was important, woke culture and woke companies were important. But, you know, losing 20% of the spending power of your saved up dollars, ouch. People may not cite the economy as often as some of those other issues when they say, why did they vote for Donald Trump? Why did they not vote for Democrats in the last election? But that underlies, the economy underlies a lot of decisions in elections, and inflation, you know, is something that will lose elections. So, as I said before, it's the duty of democratically elected officials to put the interests of their country first. So let me now turn to the ways that I think the Trump administration's approaches to economic policy have done that, and also some ways where I think they might be intending to do that, but where a different approach might be warranted. So and I'm kind of going to start out with some of what I think are already the big successes of the second Trump administration. So the first is the tax policy in what you know of as the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. The best accomplishment, in my view, economic accomplishment of President Trump's first term was his first tax bill, the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. It's based on sound principles of broadening the base and lowering rates, and it's about economic growth. So fast forward to 2025, before this Big Beautiful Bill Act, the growth projections were just 1.8% for the U.S. economy. You know, maybe for some European countries that sounds okay, but for the U.S. that really stinks. To put that in perspective, if growth had been that low over the last 50 years, the U.S. economy today would be nearly 40% smaller than it is now. So growth is super important. And there's a strong link between a well-performing economy and rising incomes across the entire income distribution. So fortunately, Congress recognized that when putting together the provisions, the tax provisions in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. And let me just go over a few of the things that I think that act did that was really well, really good. So number one, it restored and made permanent full expensing of purchases of business equipment for businesses. This may sound technical, but it's super important. You know, if you invest in new capital as a business, whether you can deduct that from your taxable income immediately or whether you have to spread it out over 20 or 30 years makes a huge difference. And this is something that economists, you know, this is widely agreed and not even a controversial matter between economists who may advise people on different sides of the aisle. I have some research together with Kevin Hassett, who's now actually in the National Economic Council, where we found that the Tax Cut and Jobs Act's business tax reforms led to much higher investment rates, and much higher actually than prior studies had indicated. So those provisions, those business provisions in the Beautiful Bill Act will provide a powerful boost to new investment and to economic activity. The act also provides permanent full expensing for research and development. That had been something that had been limited in the last tax reform. Being able to deduct from your taxable income all your expenses on research and development, super important. Some other technical changes that actually were quite important that I won't go over. On the individual side, also very, very important was the extension of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act individual income tax rate reductions. The U.S. still has marginal tax rates on higher income individuals that are, in my view, way too high. Top federal marginal tax rate in the United States is 37%. You add on to that, if you live in California, where I do, an extra 14.4%. Yeah, we're over 50% marginal tax rates where I live. Okay, so that's insane. At very least, in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, Congress prevented that 37% from going back up again to 39%. I wish they had been able to cut that rate more. My own research shows that these marginal tax rates for individuals matter a tremendous amount for economic activity. It's the Laffer curve, essentially. You know, if you tax income too much, you get fewer businesses, less business income generation, less income generation. And it's not just a question of government revenue, it's a question of prosperity. The extension of lower marginal tax rates in the Big Beautiful Bill Act, very, very important. I wish they'd been able to go further, but they did some other things that cost some money in the act. My call for fiscal policy in the U.S. and around the world is lower marginal tax rates and broaden the base. It's what the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of the first Trump administration did, and it's what we should all be doing going forward. A lot of news reports say that this Big Beautiful Bill Act is some kind of budget-busting thing. Congress's budget analysts say that the act will increase borrowing by $4 trillion on a conventional basis and by even more on a dynamic basis. I have some real issues with those calculations. I think these budget analysts that do these calculations for the U.S. government, how much is this bill going to cost? I think those are actually not relying on the most modern and recent estimates of what taxes actually do to economic activity, the way the taxes depress economic activity. My bottom line is that I don't think the One Big Beautiful Bill Act is going to increase deficits overall by very much, because there are some real growth-enhancing provisions in there that the scorers, the congressional budget analysts, are not taking into account. And Trump administration is disrupting a lot of government agencies. I have actually called for them to do some more disruption of these entities that do the scoring, that say how much a tax cut will, quote-unquote, cost an economy. Because I think that these agencies are not reflecting what we know from research about taxes, what we know the taxes do to economic activity. They depress economic activity, and the models of these agencies do not reflect that. The models of these agencies are also not transparent, so outside analysts can't go in and tweak an assumption. This is the 21st century, but they just say, "Oh, this is all too complicated for us to put out there." Well, that's not a good answer. They're responsible to the American people, responsible to the American people, and so I've been part of a call to make those models public. So on taxes, good work so far. Lots more can be done. Next area, also in the Big Beautiful Bill Act, spending cuts. So you can look at this in one of two ways. $1.2 trillion were cut from the U.S. federal government budget over the next 10 years. And this was generally through implementing work and community service requirements for what's called Medicaid. Medicaid is the public health program for the poor in the United States, it used to be for the poor, but now if you make three times the poverty line in most places, you can qualify for Medicaid. So it's sort of become a kind of creeping universal health program, and one that has really bad results in terms of demonstrating efficient impacts on health. So it's good that they were taking aim at that. Medicaid is one of the cost drivers that's driving up U.S. government budget deficits. So it's good that they did that, and putting in, you know, community service requirements or work requirements. You have to at least show that you're 20 hours a week, you're doing something. This seems completely reasonable. If Democrats were being honest, they would also agree that it's reasonable. It's even in the spirit of President Bill Clinton's reforms to welfare in the 1990s. But the spending side of the budget is totally out of control in the United States. You know, I think maybe many of you have heard the fact that the U.S. government spends more on interest on its debt than on its military. You've probably all heard that. Most of you heard that. How much are we talking about here? Well, the U.S. government spends 20% of every revenue dollar it receives straight out the door to pay interest on the national debt. That is a problem that any presidential administration that is serious about America's role in the world, America's ability to retain its sovereignty, America's ability to defend itself, has got to take on. And you know, 20%, it could turn out much worse. So Congress's budget analysts, the ones that I criticize a lot, they do some projections based on some numbers that they put out. They don't emphasize this or do the calculation, but I calculate based on the government's own projections that these interest payments will rise to around 23% of government revenues by 2035. But it turns out that, as with their tax modeling, their modeling of this is missing some very, very key things. Congress's budget analysts assume that interest rates in the federal debt are going to remain exactly where they are now. Right now, the U.S. government pays around 3.4% interest on the debt that it has outstanding. And the Congress's budget analysts just assume that that's going to remain where it is. What a crazy assumption. Right now, every dollar of new debt that the federal government issues is at much higher rates than that. So in some work that I've done that I brought in front of Congress this spring, I stress test some of those assumptions. And it turns out that if you just have interest payments, interest expenses, interest rates that are 1 percentage point higher than the CBO assumes, that these interest payments end up consuming around 40% of all non-Social Security revenues by 2035, so in the next 10 years. This is an incredibly dangerous situation. And while I'm very happy that these spending cuts made their way into the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, they're nowhere near sufficient. And I very much wish that President Trump would use his incredible ability to bring members of Congress along on his agenda in order to address this problem. He needs to just tell people, look, you do this, and I will support you in your next election campaign. You don't, and you won't. This is actually the one issue that really threatens America over the not just the long run, but the short to medium run, because it's completely 40% of our revenues going to interest payments in 10 years. Not good. So anyway, moves in the right direction, probably given the razor-thin majority that Republicans had in Congress. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act did about as well as we could hope, but much more work to be done there, both on lowering taxes and on lowering spending by even more. Third area, okay, trade policy is what you've all been waiting for, right? So let me give a charitable view and then some criticism. So I see actually three reasons for the possibility of some protectionist trade policy in the United States. Number one is China. And I think a lot of people were hoping that the Trump administration's trade policies and the tariff policy would be targeted at areas where the supply chain in the U.S. runs through China in very key areas. It's understandable that we don't necessarily want key supply chains for things that are really vital to us, say rare earth metals, refined rare earths, which go into the production processes of so many things. It's understandable we wouldn't want those things to just flow directly through China. Of course, the instruments that the Trump administration has used are a lot more blunt. He hasn't just taken on China, he's taken on a lot of other things. Second kind of charitable view is just anything where there's a national security component. You can understand why you might want some protectionism there. And the third is just as a way of negotiating non-trade barriers. And the idea I think that the Trump administration has, the way I read it, is that we're going to put tariffs on a lot of countries of the world, and they're going to figure out what their trade barriers are to us. They're going to lower them, and then we're going to cut deals with them. So this has been an interesting approach. It's been successful in a couple places. You know, Canada eliminated the digital service tax it had against U.S. companies as part of the negotiation around this. I know here in Switzerland, there's some head-scratching going on. Why are we facing a 39% reciprocal tariff rate plus another 10% baseline rate, 49% tariff rate? What did we do? I have some sympathy for you there, and I could give some advice, which is that it's probably a good idea to just do what Israel did, which is to say, you know what, from now on, our rates on everything, on all U.S. imports will be zero, and we're going to get rid of these A, B, and C trade barriers, announce some great new things, and no, you're not giving in if you do that, right? Because the reason is it's optimal for the Swiss people to have zero tariffs on imports. That's the thing about free trade, is that even if another country puts tariffs on you, it is still optimal for you to have zero tariffs. So look for a few things where you can improve, make an announcement, and then, all right, you know, it's unfortunate. U.S. imports are about 4% of Swiss GDP, but it's not the end of the world here. So, you know, do a couple of those things, and I could see things getting better. Other reasons why I think the tariff policy has been potentially not as bad as some people might say is in the U.S. we're talking about around $4 trillion of imports. Taxing that at 10% could bring in some $200 billion per year, and we do need revenue. I guess tariff revenue is worse than income tax revenue, although I've changed my thinking about this a little bit based on my research about the income tax in the U.S. And the income tax is discouraging so much business formation, so much economic activity. Tariffs are distortionary. Well, all taxes are distortionary. We need to just cut spending so we don't have to deal with this as much. Problems with, I think, the Trump administration's approach to trade is the question of who is bearing the cost. And also, frankly, within the administration, you weren't really allowed to argue that the U.S. consumers would bear any of the costs. U.S. consumers are going to bear some of the cost. It's going to be a mix. Obviously, foreign producers are going to bear some of the cost. Otherwise, you wouldn't be upset about a 39% reciprocal tax tariff rate. You know, overall, I think this has been a somewhat erratic direction the administration has gone. I don't think it's all bad, but I'm hoping that maybe as time goes on, it will become more targeted, and that countries that show that they're willing to eliminate a few trade barriers, non-tariff trade barriers, and any existing tariffs will get will see the Trump administration lowering tariff rates on them. Few other points to make. Okay, another kind of key area of Trumponomics, I think, is what we would call industrial policy and what's been going on with NVIDIA and Intel. And you've probably read the Trump administration took a 10% stake for the federal government in Intel. The argument that was made to Intel was, look, our predecessor, the Biden administration, voted all of these subsidies in for you, Intel, for chip making. You're actually failing and not doing very well, so we're going to take a 10% stake in you, but we're going to keep those subsidies going. Not a real fan of state capitalism, where the state takes large stakes in companies. Never seems to go very well. The state is not a very good shareholder. I'd like to just see less subsidies going on and not have government share ownership. NVIDIA is another one. I think quite reasonably, NVIDIA was told it can't export its special GPU AI chips to China. Then it was told it could do so as long as the U.S. government received a 15% revenue stream. Again, I think we should ask, what is really in America's interest? Probably what's in America's interest is that China doesn't get those chips. And maybe you believe that they're going to get the chips anyway, and then it's good the government gets some revenue stream. I get it. But this is just smacks a little bit of state crony capitalism, which I think is not a direction that any country has really done that well in. So I don't give that high grades on this industrial policy part to Trumponomics. Final couple points, and then we'll turn it over for discussion. Another aspect of the Trump administration, the first Trump administration was extremely successful, was the deregulation of a number of very, very key areas. Some areas that got some attention were the 5G antenna cell sites, a lot of deregulation that led to a lot of construction there. Telehealth waivers, some of that came during COVID, which is a great way to maybe bring down health expenditures. The FDA's generic drug competition push, which my colleague Casey Mulligan has done a lot of work on. And most recently in the current administration, trying to use whatever power the administration has to reduce the cost of these environmental reviews for large infrastructure projects in particular. So one of the reasons the U.S. is so bad at building large infrastructure is that the environmental reviews that the government does can take up years or, a decade would not be an exaggeration. So the National Environmental Protection Act, NEPA, is one of the big, one of the big culprits here. And the Trump administration has done some great work on reducing the impact of NEPA requirements. And Congress has done some of it also in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Very cleverly, actually, Congress put in a provision that you could, for a small fee, companies doing infrastructure projects could fast track the NEPA review. Great idea, because the cost to the companies of having to go through waiting for a decade to get an infrastructure project approved, a NEPA review, is massive compared to a small cost of fast-tracking a NEPA review. So some very good things going on there in deregulation. Finally, disrupting institutions. As I mentioned, there's some other institutions I'd like to see disrupted, maybe more, even more than the ones that he's already disrupted. I'd like to see the Congressional Budget Office disrupted with their calculations of how much tax cuts would cost the economy, because they don't really reflect true responses in economic activity in there. I'd like to see that going on. Big question, of course, people are paying attention to is the Fed. The Fed is probably politicized against President Trump now, and there are some totally unqualified people there on the board. I think the question is who the replacements are going to be. So far, what I've seen is that I think President Trump doesn't want to tank the stock market, he doesn't want to tank the dollar. And the Taylor rule, which is kind of the basic rule that economists use to determine what the right level of interest rates should be by the federal government, actually does have interest rates decline. Shows interest rates should be lower than they are now. So we'll see. I don't think anybody wants the Fed to be politicized. I don't want the Fed to be politicized. I think it's probably more politicized right now than it will be if some of the people who President Trump is thinking about replacing get replaced. So I think if I take the America First premise as given, which I think is a totally valid premise in a democracy, on net, I think there's some good and some bad. I think the good probably outweighs the bad so far, but there is a lot of damage potentially being done by some of the bad. I think the biggest damage would be forcing our foreign adversaries together, seeing the presidents of China, Russia, India, and Iran getting together without the United States makes me very, very concerned. And you know, you can say you want an America First policy, that's great, but it's not an America First policy if you're driving our foreign adversaries, who each individually might have been adversaries of us but weren't working together, to work together. So I think we should give some thought to that. And I think if the Trump administration wants a defining legacy, you know, fix the budget. I mean, DOGE was kind of a weak attempt. All of us knew all along that Congress would have to be brought along in order for real spending reform to be made. And the fact is that President Trump has the charisma, he has the leadership, he could actually fix these budgetary problems if he wanted to, and that would really be an America First policy for the future. So those are the remarks I have today on Trumponomics that I prepared, and looking forward to the discussion. So.
Okay, great, thanks, Josh. And I'll start with a few questions and then we'll take the audience questions. You know, one thing you pointed out that strikes me is there's sort of the schizophrenic economic policy of the Trump administration, in that he pushes deregulation and sort of lower taxes for Americans. Yet at the same time, he adds these tariffs. He takes a stake in private enterprise. This is sort of what you termed as erratic. I wonder how that impacts decision-making of, our European allies and the rest of the world when we have mixed messages coming out. Just as a general principle, there's a clear inconsistency in my view.
Right, well, it's a great question. I think to see the context of it, and maybe to help understand, to help people understand a little bit better, why does it look this way? The Republican Party in the United States for a long time has won elections when it's able to bring together a coalition of two groups of people. One are the sort of traditional free market, more libertarian folks, and the others are the more people you would consider to be the national conservatives. And the issue is that there's a real tension in the policies that those two groups of people would espouse. So the libertarian free marketers are talking about all the things that I was praising, lowering tax rates, broadening the tax base, economic activity, vibrant private sector, business dynamism, bringing the whole economy up through economic growth. National conservatism has always had an element of protectionism in it. It's always had an element of saying, okay, government ownership of stakes in companies. So I think part of what we're seeing is just a reflection of the fact that the Republican Party has always been a bit of a combination of those two groups, and when they are able to work together to some extent, they get elected. What we've seen now is that maybe neither one of those groups is really controlling economic policy. It seems like the national conservative kind of approach is winning out to some extent. In terms of what our international allies and how they perceive the situation, I mean, it is quite disorienting, and I think it would probably behoove the administration to be a bit clearer on its signal of where exactly it's hoping to go. You know, as I mentioned, the administration has struck some trade deals, some deals with various countries to get rid of policies that were non-tariff trade barriers that were detrimental to the U.S. Canada's digital service tax, for example. It seems like if a country signals to the Trump administration that they're interested in looking at what are the trade barriers that actually exist, even if it's unfair, it's unfair that Switzerland has seems to be being punished with a higher tariff rate than other countries. Fine, it's unfair, but that's what you got. So let's look at maybe what you can do, offer something, and and see how you can work with the administration. So I wouldn't deny that it's disorienting for our allies, but I think there are ways to approach the problem.
You know, on these trade asymmetries, why is it really true that there's something unfair about a trade imbalance? I mean, why is it unfair? There is a mutual, you know, the benefits in a general sense of free trade or trade, as like Milton Friedman and others talked about for decades as foundational principles in economics. A trade imbalance is not necessarily a negative because there's something else going on. I mean, could you sort of explain that?
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it is insipid to decide you're going to charge tariff rates as a function of just a bilateral trade imbalance, or to conclude that because the U.S. has a bigger bilateral trade deficit with one country, that country is ripping us off more than another country. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. And because if there's a big trade imbalance with a country, it means that the United States likes purchasing the things that the country is offering at the prices that it's offering them.
Right, and it's a voluntary transaction.
It's a voluntary transaction. And so that approach is an approach that I criticize quite heavily and will continue to criticize. It really is not, bilateral trade deficits are not a sign of a ripoff going on or something like that. I think, you know, looking at it somewhat more charitably, what I would just point out is that I think this tariff policy has been an attempt to bring countries to the table for negotiations. And every country in the world has got some kind of trade barrier that's out there. That's, you know, you can look at it, you can find non-tariff trade barriers, you can find tariffs. And so the best that you can do is reduce those because those are best for the people of every individual country.
Right. Why is it that the tariffs don't seem to have had the calamitous impact that people predicted in the United States, or have they? I mean, as a non-economist, I look at this and we had all been told that these tariffs were so harmful, and yet we have the stock market at record highs. We don't have an increase in inflation.
Yeah.
What is the impact of the tariffs really, or are they yet to come?
I think some is yet to come. You know, the first thing, the first challenge is that there's a lot of uncertainty as to what the actual tariff rate is going to settle at for a lot of things and towards a lot of countries. And so businesses, when they're thinking about what are the prices we're going to set, you know, they don't want to necessarily increase prices by, you know, 20% now on consumers and then have to cut them by 10% later. So in the short run, it seems quite plausible that businesses would absorb some of the costs. As would foreign exporters would absorb some of the costs. I think in the longer run, most of the evidence shows in the longer run, U.S. consumers bear the cost. And that's not, you know, I think there's a lot of confusion about whether that is, quote unquote, inflation or not. I mean, that is a higher price level. The Federal Reserve should not respond to those types of higher price levels by raising interest rates. That would create a recession. Federal Reserve is there to respond to inflation. So I think it's still too early to know what the economic effects are going to be. And it may be that through some of these negotiations that go on, that the administration can somehow get or induce foreign, you know, non-U.S. producers to absorb more of the cost of these. But I think, you know, the studies are pretty clear that over the medium, starting in the medium term, you know, medium to long run, consumers bear the burden of tariffs. And in the same way that, you know, it's similar to companies are very good at passing on corporate income taxes to consumers. We know that. They're also very good at passing on tariffs to consumers. And so, you know, consumers will ultimately bear the cost, in my view.
Okay, one more question and I'll open it up. The concept of the strength of the U.S. dollar and its relevance to our allies or the world, the U.S. dollar has devalued since Trump took over. I mean, I look at, you know, everybody walking around Zurich. It used to be close to 1-to-1. Now it's 0.8. I wonder, is it actually important for the world or the free, you know, the allies of the U.S. that the U.S. economy is strong, that the dollar is actually strong? Is there a benefit and this idea of what will happen if there's some kind of a debt crisis in the U.S. in terms of the so-called reserve currency, these kinds of issues. The U.S. as an integral, the strength as an integral part of European strength and peace.
It's not only the weakness of the dollar that you've observed, it's also the fact that central banks are holding around the world, are holding less US dollars as their reserves. They're holding more gold, they're holding somewhat more euros and other currencies, but the holdings of the US dollar are way down by central banks. There's still about 55% of central bank reserve currencies. But they're down, and that down from around 70% 15 years ago. That reflects reduced confidence in the U.S. dollar. And you ask a question, to what extent does the world need the U.S. dollar to play this role as a reserve currency? It is extremely valuable for the world to have a currency, something to rely on that is a reserve currency, because it allows countries to have effective monetary policy. So I think that if we have an unanchoring of the U.S. dollar, we're going to have a couple. We're going to have inflation in the United States. That's my prediction: is we're going to have more inflation in the United States. We're going to have basically more episodes of what we saw, unfortunately, during the last administration, where lots of excess spending turned into deficit spending turned into inflation. We're going to see more of that. And I think the likely impact of that on the rest of the world is that that problem will be exported to the rest of the world if the dollar loses its status as the reserve currency.
Do you think that there, I said one last question, but the move toward digital currency, there is some sort of move toward, crypto or whatever you want to call this, although there's a conflict of interest potentially with the whole Trump family and their personal holdings, but that's really not the question. Is what is going on with that? How realistic is that to become something that is used as transactional rather than a speculative stock investment, et cetera? What is the status of this? What's going on with digital currency?
Right. Well, as I mentioned before, right now what central banks are turning back to is gold. And that gold was kind of the old thing that you would anchor yourself on if you didn't have anything else to anchor yourself on. Can Bitcoin replace that? I don't think it has anything to do with Trump coin or any of these other cryptocurrencies. I think it's really about Bitcoin. Or if Bitcoin, something bad happens to Bitcoin, then I guess maybe Ethereum is next. Or there might, people who are experts in crypto can tell me what the next one down the list is if something bad happens to Bitcoin. But I think it's possible. I think it's possible. Why did the world anchor around gold? It was because gold was extremely valuable as a commodity. Now gold is not as important as a commodity. And Bitcoin has a lot to recommend it, including its fixed supply. The world's monetary system would have to work out exactly how you deal with the fact that there is literally a fixed supply. Is you have economic, if you have economic growth and everything is all money is pegged to Bitcoin and fixed supply, then you'd actually have price deflation. So there's going to have to be central banks are going to have to work out some kind of way of having a peg with some kind of monitored inflation or devaluation of local currency prices relative to that. I think there's still great potential there. I think we just don't know. As an investor, I like to tell people. I'll tell you all here. That I get mocked by my colleagues at the Stanford Graduate School of Business for investing any money at all in Bitcoin. I don't invest a lot in Bitcoin, but I have discussions around the lunch table. I own some cryptocurrency. My colleagues tell me I'm a fool, that it's not worth anything, there's nothing backing it. Well, we'll see. They're extremely confident. And the way I view it, maybe there's a 70% chance they're right. Maybe there's a 30% chance I'm right. I thought in finance we're supposed to be hedging, right? And we have to also be a little bit modest that we don't really know what's going to happen. And it's possible that Bitcoin could become something that around which the world's monetary system is anchored. And it's not smart to have 0% of your assets in that. I mean, you have to be extremely confident in your view to have it be zero, given the number of people who are of the belief that this could be something real.
Okay. Okay, let's open it up to questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Josh, for the presentation. You mentioned something extraordinary, which is 40% of the revenue will be paid on interest in 10 years, I believe you said.
Yep.
If we make the assumption that politicians will not solve the situation, how do you see the economy in 10 years? How this will impact not only the growth rates, but the structure of the economy, or which sectors are going to be more harmed by this situation?
Well, what's bound to happen is higher inflation, because what will happen, there will be another event over the next 10 years that is described as some kind of national emergency. I mean, we have these national emergencies that come along. You know, we had the great financial crisis, we had COVID. You know, there'll be something else. If not 10 years, then 15 years, right? There'll be something else. The US government and all of these crises always, what do? They ratchet up spending dramatically. I mean, that's the first thing you do, is just spend. And they've got a playbook for how to do that, which is to involve the Federal Reserve in doing a lot of bond buying. So Federal Reserve, Central Bank, they'll say, well, we're independent. We don't buy the bonds directly from the Treasury. We let the Treasury issue them to banks, and then we buy them the next day. It's the same thing. It's monetizing the debt. There's going to be more monetization of debt, and we're going to end up with more inflation like what we've had. So that's what the macroeconomic consequences are going to be of not addressing the budget. You know, what sectors will be hurt? Well, I mean, you know, we know what inflation does, right? Inflation helps. It helps debtors and you know, hurts creditors. It helps debtors because it inflates away the nominal value of what it is that you have to pay, but it hurts anybody who is saving or investing, and it's going to be very damaging to investment in the economy.
Hello, can you hear me? Good morning. Thank you again, as always, for giving us your insights. I could listen for a long time. I took copious notes here. For example, I hadn't realized we had made a change to the PP&E laws. Hopefully now that removes ASC 606 for those in the room who have ever experienced that and know the pains of that law. I also very much appreciate all your comments around the tariffs. I was, thank you for connecting us with our Swiss colleagues earlier. I was poorly explaining to them, Ben, I'm not sure if you're around, I grabbed his card because I want to find someone in Treasury and ask them a few questions to try to help our Swiss friends here. But specifically, and actually before I get to that, I very much appreciate your points on CBO and of our mandatory spending cut, $1.2 trillion. I realized I was a fool because I knew you and I never reached out. I was actually one of five folks who did those cuts at Medicaid and Medicare. And when CBO came out with their scoring saying that we were going to put 10 million people unemployed or uninsured, that became a real problem. And then, sorry, is this open or closed to press? Please remind me. Close to press. I'm happy to give some sausage making as well, but basically the Rural Health Transformation Fund, the $50 billion fund, came out of that those cuts as a tool to help One Big Beautiful Bill pass. And that's really the reason we were able to get across the finish line, because of those $1.2 trillion cuts, and the fund was able to target those senators from Alaska, senators from Maine, to be able to get across the finish line. But my question here is primarily around the tariffs. Can you speak more? I know, you know, you're an economist, but can you speak more about the tariffs as a real politic tool? As I said earlier, I was poorly explaining to our Swiss friends about how it can be used as a real politic tool. And I'll use two examples here. One is maybe take the UK, right? They have a lot of free speech issues right now, as we heard at last year's conference as well. Can you speak to how tariffs can be used as a tool there? And second, and this is perhaps maybe a little bit of disagreement to both of your guys' earlier points around trade deals. If a trade deal exists, maybe therefore it's fair. One thing I'm working on right now is the president's executive order on MFN, most favored nation, drug pricing. And so the issue there is akin to NATO, where in the United States, our drug companies do hundreds of billions of dollars of R&D to develop some of the latest and greatest drugs to help improve lives. And then we sell those drugs, let's say $1,000 per unit in the United States. There's many reasons for that, including our convoluted drug system, PBMs, rebates, all that good stuff. But the problem is they then go to Europe and the European governments negotiate much lower prices, say $100 per unit. And so I believe President Trump's executive order paired with tariffs allow us to go to Europe and say, hey guys, pay up, while at the same time shield our United States companies from those negotiations, and we're able to lower drug prices essentially in the United States. So I was wondering if you could speak more to tariffs as a real politic tool on social change, but also as a shield to allow our U.S. companies to negotiate better trade deals with foreign nations, where it's maybe not as fair, where they're negotiating against a government versus, you know, a company.
I think it's very fair to view tariffs as part of a negotiating tool. And as you pointed out, it doesn't have to just be over trade issues. It can be over issues like free speech or other areas where the U.S. would benefit from other from countries adopting better policies across the board. I think my only comment about that is it would be nice then to be more targeted. Like, couldn't we have come up with a list of things that other countries are doing, specific other countries that are really actually harmful to the United States interests, and really target those instead of just sort of doing this blanket thing and then let's bring every country to the table to negotiate and you know see what they come up with. Because then you end up with Switzerland really should be one of the greatest American allies. I mean, we share so much in terms of our views about federalism. Within the continent of Europe, Switzerland should be truly one of our best and closest allies, and yet we're sort of punishing them the most. So I just like it to be more targeted on. I totally agree with you on the negotiation front, and on the specific example also you gave about drug pricing. I think this is an area that, and maybe I'll turn to you to say a few words about this, Scott, because who is it that's striking these really bad deals with the European countries, and why is it happening?
Yeah, I'm sort of I'm very opposed to the U.S. having specific pricing policies on drugs as a general principle. First of all, I think there's this idea that, and the Biden administration did this. They capped prices on certain drugs. They allow Medicare. When you have Medicare, when you have a single large buyer to negotiate, it's almost a monopoly. I guess the word is monopsony or something. But so you end up having price caps. The most favored nation sort of pricing policy for other countries, I just think that's an overreach of government. It interferes with the pricing. I think the private companies that develop the drugs, the U.S. population benefits from that money. In fact, I can't think of something where the U.S. innovation has more benefit to Americans than pharma. And so it's all very complicated, partly because the health department in the United States has this sort of, in my perception, there's a war on pharma going on top of everything else, as if it's evil. And so the reality is that I don't see a problem. Okay, if other countries, there's some kind of a strange concept of fairness. Fairness is in the eye of the beholder. I don't think the government is trying to be the moral arbiter of fairness. I just think that we're sort of off track in that. So I don't have it's very complicated, the drug pricing that other countries pay or whatever. I mean, I don't want to import their price controls. The U.S. American consumer benefits tremendously from the drug availability. Most, just as one statistic, regardless of the pricing, there are other things to do to bring down the cost of drugs besides having this idea about the foreign prices are a real problem. That's not true. There's all kinds of unnecessary costs in drug development that have exploded in the United States. The deregulation that Josh mentioned that Trump is very good about is a way to bring down the prices to Americans. I don't care what the price is to a small country somewhere else. They don't have access to these drugs anyway. If you look at the new drugs in healthcare, almost all of them are oncology drugs, cancer drugs. And of the something like 34 or 50, let's say, new drugs over the past 3 years for cancer, Americans had access to 95% of them within 2 years. Countries in Europe, they had less than half. People die from that. It's hard to assess the value of that. If my daughter had breast cancer, I want the drug. It's hard to put a price tag on it. Not everything is that simple. So we have a president who uses the financial trade-offs of things as almost single-minded in terms of benefit and cost, but there's a lot more to it than that. So I think it's sort of misguided. I almost think it's theater to start saying, hey, it's unfair that people in nation X pay only 40%. We're paying for that. Okay, but we get the drugs. I mean, we want the drugs. It's interfering with, you can't talk free market and then interfere with free market. And actually that's going on quite a bit. Again, I'll defer to Josh, but as a non-economist, you know, I see my country talk a big game about free markets and then start saying, you know what, we're going to take a percentage of money from NVIDIA sales to China. I thought it was a national security issue. It's not a money issue. Or we're going to buy Intel. What? That is the definition. Control of the supply by the state is the definition of Marxism, you know, the means of supply. So I just think there's a lot of confusing things going on, and I actually think it's theater by people in the HHS and the health sector to start saying, hey, the big issue right now is that, Albania is paying 10% of what Americans pay for drugs. Okay, I mean, there's a lot more important things to do than that.
Amber Todorov with Open the Books, but hearing your speech was very interesting and disturbing, and the entitlement spending is particularly interesting and alarming, and you're talking about how Trump can work with Congress to kind of like lower the cost of this, but of course the political repercussions of that would be potentially devastating if Democrats win and unleash more spending than we can imagine. What is the political solution in your mind? I would love a political solution to reducing entitlement spending and not losing elections massively for the Republicans. Yeah,
that's a great point. And there is definitely a risk of going too far and you know, leading to loss of control of the government and going back into the hands of people who will just increase those entitlements even more. That's a terrific point. I guess what I would say is that, what we did with the Medicaid work requirements was a great thing. It mirrors, as I mentioned, what Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton did with the welfare reform in the 1990s. I mean, it's quite incredible that a Democratic president campaigned and said, I'm going to end welfare as we know it. And then he did it by putting in, a lot of work requirements and changes. It's not perfect. Some of it's been rolled back. But that was a substantial reform of an entitlement program that I think his administration deserves a lot of credit for, and so the Medicaid work requirements were a really terrific one, and I think they're one that just can't take too much political heat. I mean, they can say you cut Medicaid, but these requirements are work requirements are having to show that you're looking for a job or show that you're doing community service, show that you're doing something.
Even education
counts, right? That's very consistent with American values, and so I think you're completely correct that we have to be mindful of this. But there are also a lot of areas where we can do things that can be explained to the American people that are consistent with American values. I think America is a country that fundamentally does not think most people do not think that you should just be living off the government. And I think it's also very important to make sure that the lines of communication are open, are really the communication about these reforms are really good, and to say that this is really going to be better for people in the long run. It's a very, very good point. Politicians are in a difficult bind. And you know what? If you ask me, my prediction is that they're not going to succeed, and that we're going to have the inflationary scenario that I mentioned, and that only then, eventually, after a few more episodes of losing 20% of your spending power time and time again, hopefully limited to that, people will eventually, someone will eventually be able to put it together for the American people that it's the excessive government spending that's driving these inflationary episodes that we're gonna keep seeing, and that then we'll have some change. But I think it's gonna require a fair amount of economic pain before it actually happens.
And in the meantime, we have a New York City mayor who's about to be elected, who's promising more and more entitlements. Of all the schisms in the United States, one of the biggest is there's a large group of people who want more entitlements, more government centralization, and more spending. And frankly, a lot of that is centered in people under 30. So it's a problem that we need the young people in the room to fix. I think we'll have to end it there, but we'll continue the economic discussion with the next panel. So we'll take a 10-minute break, set up for the next panel, and then we'll continue in economics, and Noah can ask his question.
Thanks. That was fun. Really fun. Great. Enjoyed it. Thanks.